the first 18 months of business ownership is terrible. Literally 6 months in, I was curled up on my bathroom floor at 2 a.m. on a Tuesday because I thought for sure I'd ruin my wife and I's, you know, retirement money. And so it's an interesting turn of events. You know, we'll probably do a little over $30 million in sales in 2023.
You're listening to the Next Generation Podcast, weekly interviews with the most interesting and successful 20-somethings out there.
Hi, everybody. This is Reg Zeller, the CEO at Canecast, and you're listening to the Next Generation Podcast.
Thanks for coming on, Reg. We are excited to have you here. Could you maybe give the audience a quick breakdown on, you know, what a foundry is and maybe a little bit behind the business model there and, you know, what are you guys making and selling to people?
Yeah, the easy answer for this is normally when people hear foundries, first of all, if they know what it is we actually do, that's shocking in that we melt metal, pour it into a form and make a product for somebody. Been literally the exact same industry for the last 6,000 years, just slight technology changes of how to make it better, faster, et cetera. But, you know, normally when people hear foundry, that's become a really interesting word to name apartment complexes or software development firms or anything else off. But no, we're actually the really dirty manufacturing portion that, you know, that legit melt, in our case, aluminum mainly to, you know, 1300-1400 degrees, get it molten, looks like a bath of lava, and we pour it into a form to make a product for something. Those products quite literally are all around you. They're everything from what holds up railroad crossing signs to the, if a couple of weeks ago where Connor is, he could have gone to Rock Center and seen a bunch of our products. They were sitting there in the, right in the middle of the area. So everything that you kind of touch, feel, et cetera, like 70-80% of the metal you see is made from some form of a casting.
And then off of that, you guys have been going around and buying up these foundries, right? And kind of rolling them up under one, I guess we're going to dive into it later, but Holdco or, you know, whatever the actual words are there.
Yeah. The simple answer was, you know, my background, spent 17 years in corporate America, an electrical engineering undergrad at some point in time, picked up an MBA in there as well, but jumped around big, mainly engineering companies that manufactured stuff. And so after getting done with that, realized I didn't want to be on the side of the table of the folks in the tailored suits and making font changes to PowerPoints. I actually wanted to be on the other side of the table of the small business owners that owned anything from an electrical contractor to small manufacturing and everything in between. My kind of thesis is the new word. I didn't even know that was a thing back 6 years ago when I started this was, I believe that there was going to be a need for US-based manufacturing, small local manufacturing. I wanted to own 100% because I don't do well working for other people. So I went and found something that was small enough that I could buy with bank debt. At the time, literally didn't have any idea what an SBA loan was, didn't know what I really needed for an accountant or a lawyer or anything else, because I'd done M&A in corporate, but there it's a lot different. You go buy $1 billion business and there's a team of 50 around you. They just kind of take care of it. And at some point in time, you call the corporate treasurer and say, hey, I need $1 billion wired to this number. And they say, okay, we'll have that done later today. And so it's a wee bit different than when you're doing it yourself. But yeah, I had no idea what we were doing. And once we bought one, jumped in, understood, we really liked the fundamentals of the business, bought a second one to help us mainly just with the equipment that we needed. And now we're about to buy our seventh, 5.5 years later.
Damn, congratulations. And to go from the story of like kind of jumping into that small business world, not really having any idea what you're doing to where you guys are at today, can you give like some level of scale in terms of where you guys are at? It sounds like about seven facilities, a couple of different states.
Yep. Yeah. So our expectation right now, so once we complete this acquisition, which LOI done, everything is just kind of dotting the I's and crossing the T's at this point in time, which I'm happy to get into that. It's a little different when you buy your seventh one compared to thinking about buying your first. But, you know, for us, we'll be in five different states. We'll probably do a little over $30 million in sales in 2023. And so it's an interesting turn of events. You know, everything we've done, kind of tell everybody when we first bought it, it was need to put 10 to 15% down was at the time what you needed for an SBA. So put in somewhere in the neighborhood of $300,000, and we bought everything else just with the cash flows that the rest of the companies have done.
That's the definition of compounding, of snowballing it all up. That's awesome. Exactly. All right. So I'm with Gio on this one too. And I think people listening to this can probably relate, as I'm sure you probably get a lot of cocktail parties. I've just never heard of casting prior to this. Yeah. And I think you did a pretty good articulate job of just explaining what it is and how it kind of is in everything around us.
Yeah.
I would love to maybe hear the story of how you got into this industry, specifically coming from GE. Like, maybe it's just like you knew it from working at GE for so long.
It sounds like you didn't have any background in boundaries when you first bought it.
Here's the great story about this. And I've told this to a few people, but I just got totally sideways with my boss in August of 2016. He literally, without getting into too much detail, was bothering me all weekend. I was so far up north with a bunch of my buddies that we couldn't get cell phone reception. And on Monday, he said, "Hey, we need to talk." He called me at 4:45 because he was on the East Coast and went to work at 6. So he thought it'd be funny to call me on his drive into work. He did it all the time. And he said, "Hey, if you don't tell me again when you go on vacation, I'm going to fire you." And I was like, "What are you talking about, vacation?" He's like, "Yeah, I was trying to get a hold of you on Saturday." And I was like, "Oh, so now Saturdays are considered vacation. I don't know if I could swear on your podcast, but you could probably guess my words right after that." It started with an F and rhymed with duck about what I thought about him. But anyway, so yeah, I just started searching, but came home, told my wife, said, "Hey, we're going to figure out your career, but I'm done." 2 months, you know, just started, I guess at this point in time, you call it a process, but just started talking to people, had done some looking before. Business had popped up on BizBuySell. I knew I wanted it. Looked at a bunch of different things. Nothing really. And now I learned a bunch, you know, 6 weeks, 8 weeks, whatever. Yeah, something came up. It just happened to be close. We were willing to move all over the country, but decided we didn't need to because something showed up right at our back door. I'd never stepped foot in a foundry before. I kind of knew what they were. We bought castings before, having an engineering background and being a general manager and a product manager in manufacturing companies. But yeah, I just walked in and said, "Hey, this checks some of the boxes and that I can afford it, 100% myself without having to get that boss." And then kind of my background in corporate strategy, business strategy, M&A, just did a deep dive into the industry over the next 4 to 6 weeks and realized, hey, there's something that might really be here, and ended up making an offer on it. And literally from the time I walked in, it was almost exactly 6 years ago today, we closed on it January 31st. So, you know, first business I ever visited, first business I ever technically wrote an LOI on, bought it and off and running.
Quick follow-up there. Was the goal to get a foundry business, or was the goal to buy a
just kind of manufacturing,
small business, and you just happened to be, that's the first one that you thought was interesting on BizBuySell?
Yeah, I mean, just honestly, what it amounted to was I wanted to be in small manufacturing because that's what I grew up in. So I graduated my undergrad in 2002, electrical engineering, computer engineering, software engineering, all like 99% of my friends went into something related to joke for years now. If whatever product we make, I can drop on my foot and it hurts, I'll be interested. There's people that are a hell of a lot better at doing software development, you know, SaaS companies. I am so far out of my league when it comes to that shit that I'm like, nah, I'm good. I'm going to stick over here in the niche that I know. And it's very, I mean, it's rare. I'm early 40s, getting closer to mid 40s now, I suppose. I don't know anybody in this industry that's my age. And if I look around manufacturing, that's pretty common. And a lot of that was because everything moved overseas, you know, through the 80s and 90s, everything was moving Mexico, China, wherever it might be. And my entire thesis and theory on this was, you know, we need to do manufacturing overseas or in Mexico or wherever as well, but it can't be a zero manufacturing here in the US. I thought that there'd be a niche that we can go figure out. So it didn't matter to me. I'd run so many different businesses in my life, went from thermostats to solar. It was like, whatever, it's just a business. I'll figure out how to do it. And I thought boundaries were going to be a lot easier. on that out a little differently, but here we are.
It always seems easier on paper.
Yeah, for sure.
You made a comment, I think like 5 or 10 minutes ago, that foundries, when you were looking at it, like do have a pretty good they have pretty good economics to them, pretty good business model. Can you explain what you meant by that?
I would say that I thought they had good economics. I was also told that I was an idiot, and most people thought that that was a terrible idea for me to get into. I think somehow I tweeted this out at some point in time, but I fundamentally believe in doing your own research, figuring out what's going to work for you and what's not. And what happened was we went into it. I just saw a lot of positive trends. I saw some obscenely major risks, mainly around people. But generally speaking, I thought there was going to be more demand coming back here. I thought there'd be a better way to serve that. And especially as you see supply drop out, and it's not just supply that's dropping out domestically, but it's impossible to buy one of these foundries. Even now, 5-6 years later, it's substantially worse. Back then, there were still a lot of people in their late 50s, early 60s that knew the small foundry industry, and that just doesn't exist anymore. When this product, you know, you kind of think 80s, 90s, 2000s, when everything was moving, no one came into the industry. So everybody that was running these businesses were owner operators. 80% of foundries have gone out of business in the last 50 years. Probably another 30, 50% are going to go out of business in the next 2, 3, 4 years. Some of that's COVID related. Some of that's just aging out. And their real estate where these places are worth more than what the business is. So we're in a very, very unique spot that we can continue to buy and roll up. But yeah, everybody that was in the industry, when I talked to them, the experts that have been there, they told me, you're an idiot. Like, don't buy. This is a terrible thing. You're going to hate it all. But I'm still one of those people. You tell me the stove's hot, I just have to touch it to verify, just to make sure. So
curious on a couple points there. Maybe what specifically were they referencing that, you know, was a bad potentially business decision by acquiring one of these? And then also, how does that compare to, you know, maybe the insourcing versus outsourcing question, right? I'm assuming to even get customers here, there's got to be some sort of competitive advantage to go with you know, local foundry rather than China or Mexico or someone with significantly cheaper production costs.
Yeah, this a lot came in from my corporate background is a few things. So generally speaking, why is because they'd lived through the 80% of foundries going out of business. So if you look back in the early 80s, there was in excess of 4,000 small aluminum foundries like what we have. When I started looking just before COVID, probably 3-4 years ago, we got to about 770 total of these that were left. So they watched more than 80% go out. I think probably another 20% of those have already gone out, but I've talked with probably a little more than 600 of them at this point in time. But their issue is they just saw the element that they had no pricing power. They had no supplier power whatsoever. From what you have, you kind of think of traditional Porter's Five Forces type work. And for me, I saw it completely differently. When you have really low volume, high mix, that's as me as a general manager, right? Back in corporate, I was having this problem. I need to buy 4 years worth of product to make it worthwhile out of China or something. Or I would have to order in quantities, but you know, I wouldn't know it was coming. And so my team would get hit with a random big order, and it would take us 4 months to get product, or we'd have to ship it via air, at which point it pretty much is a wash anyway. So it was all those insights of, you know, increasing demand, decreasing supply, an ability to have a niche. But in order to have that niche, we had to get a training academy. We had to figure out a way to get the right people in place to eliminate key man risk, you know. And then I can't say that I thought I was going to roll up a bunch of these things. I thought, you know, one, and I was going to be totally fine thinking, oh, I can make $1 million a year. That's the greatest thing ever. And then all of a sudden you're like, get that itch after you do your first one. If you're a deal junkie like me, like, oh, that's a nice shiny object over there. If I just hire someone, I could probably go buy some more of those things right there. But
oh yeah.
Yeah. So that's the roll up really wasn't the plan, but the fundamentals were totally different just because my perspective was totally different than what the people in the industry were. They just didn't realize kind of what the situation was. And at the same time, I came from a large strategic buyer, had worked a lot with private equity firms. So it was my stated goal to be underneath what a private equity firm could get into, and yet distance ourselves with moats from where a single buyer could be. And so we've got that really, really tiny niche. I mean, we're legitimately almost buyer one of one. When these things go up, I somehow get a call. Like, I don't even do outbound anymore. Everything comes inbound. The last three places we bought, someone has called me to say, hey, we're ready to sell. Either I've talked to them before, or, you know, someone finds up someone else in the industry and they're like, hey, this guy's looking to sell. It literally just happened to me yesterday. I have a follow-up call in today.
That probably gives you like pretty good pricing power too, just knowing that like there's not a lot of other alternatives out there.
Yeah. The right way to think about it, I'm in a really weird situation. My wife and I have done really well for ourselves. We don't have kids, so we're not really doing this for the money. We could sell everything and retire today. So I'm not trying to screw anybody in our industry. I'll give them what I think is the right price and I'll lay out why. Mm-hmm. Could I take it for less money? 100%. Because no one else is walking through the door to buy most of these things. But at the same time, I don't want that reputation, because they're going to go tell all of their buddies who own businesses, hey, these guys took care of us. They took care of our customers. They took care of our employees. And this is a legacy for them. And I want to honor that and make sure I really think of us as stewards for these companies. So for us, we'll go in there and I'll just be very, they'll get some crazy valuation. It's happened before, you know, some guy, their country club valuation. Oh, I saw a guy that sold a business for 12X and I'll just lay out like, guys, here's what I'm willing to pay. Some businesses are 1 or 2X we bought for. Some businesses are 3 or 4X, but we'll just walk through and be like, this is your number based on how much you're making. Here's the things we need to do. Here's the equipment we need to put in. Here's the processes, systems, people we need to train, whatever it might be. And this is why, in order, if you want this place to continue on for another 30, 40, 50, 60 years, these are the things we're going to need to do. And I have to think about not just your company, but the rest of the companies I own as well. So we certainly could, but I mean, honestly, like, this seems insane to me. I'm going to say this out loud because I've said it before and it still sounds like I'm a fucking idiot, but an extra $500,000 or $1 million in the grand scheme in this right now, comparably speaking to us, be able to source a lot more deals and become that buyer of choice for everybody, just isn't worth it. Just an extra.
How are you structuring most of these? Just from like,
I don't know, 100%. It's all debt. So
it's all debt. Are you doing any sort of seller financing, mostly SBA loans? What does that look like?
Yeah, we're past SBA. That's the, for anybody that once they get into this, they'll quickly learn when you bridge that gap anywhere from a little more than $5 million in debt, you can do some stuff, right? These banks are willing to give you $5 million SBA plus $1, $2, $3, $4 million, something like that on a secondary position. But once you get above that, when you get into 15, 20, 25 million, you have to be doing $5 million in EBITDA or else you can't get traditional financing and it's a nightmare. So you have to bridge that gap from between, you know, $1.5 million, $2 million in EBITDA to $5 million in EBITDA in any way possible. So what we did is we bought a couple of SBA deals, then refinanced out of them into something more traditional after we'd grown them. And then a few other deals, because we had the cash flow, we literally bought these businesses for essentially assets plus real estate. Maybe it'd be end up being 1x earnings. So we could finance the vast majority of it, and everything else we just cut a check for out of cash flow from our other businesses. But yeah, I refuse at this point in time to give up any equity whatsoever. I'd rather grow slow and do it right and not have to be pressured to sell. Or if I ever need to create a PowerPoint and read somebody financials on a monthly or quarterly basis, I would just quit. Be like, yep, peace, I'm out.
Yeah, so, big on the anti-boss mentality. I hear you.
Yeah, I mean, after 17 years in corporate, I've seen enough of it. It got so terrible. I felt like I wasn't doing anything. I was developing people. That was about it. But mm-hmm. The rest of my time, I was just like,
pushing slides,
literally building PowerPoints. It was the worst job ever. Like, what the hell? Why did I want to get promoted to be an executive of a company? This is terrible. Just a political game. The only thing you get value out of is once in a while you get to, you know, see people succeed. But that was about it.
Yeah, you get the title. I think I've heard from a couple of people before too that like once you look up and realize that the people above you aren't really where you want to be, then it's time to typically get out if that's the game you're playing. Yeah, I think one thing I was curious about, just because like I always love learning about like these new industries, is the stuff where you see it all around you. You don't really actually pause to think, who makes this kind of stuff? And I think that's exactly the business that you're operating today.
Yeah.
You know, I would imagine being pretty heavily involved in the small business manufacturing space that there are probably a crazy amount of other industries that are maybe not akin to like casting, but yeah, probably similar enough where like it would be something that would probably change my perspective. Any ones that come to mind that I've like probably never heard of or listened to?
Are you asking me what you can go roll up right now? I'm just curious. Is that what that is?
Gio and I have the guilty habit of anytime that we leave a call like this, we are just like, wow, we have to go and chase this new industry. This sounds super fun.
You know, so there's a ton of them. Honestly, you'd say it's not the only difference. And really, if you think about it, whether the last mile, whatever you want to think of it as. Okay, so we make a casting, but it's not that atypical from any other small manufacturing in the US. And that can be something that gets painted. That could be something where you bend metal. There's a lot of things that you fabricate. All of these things are ungodly similar, you know, same thing. And it gets a little different as you get further and further out into more machining. So like a machine shop, for instance, is the most common, probably small manufacturer in this country. Just they're ubiquitous. They're everywhere. There's literally thousands of them in Minneapolis, St. Paul, where I'm sitting right now. And every city is kind of similar to that has manufacturing. I don't like that industry personally because anybody can replicate it. You go buy a machining center and you can suddenly compete with me out of your garage as long as you pull 220, you know, into there. That's not what I want to do. There's just not enough of a moat. But anything else is feasible with this, to the point where so Josh Schultz, president of our company, partner in making this thing happen, he's developing all kinds of automated systems for us, not just on the operations side, but also all of our accounting, you know, finance, you name it. We're actually going to take this just because we have a capability of doing this that other people don't. In the short term, we're going to help other small manufacturers, much smaller than us, be able to go implement a lot of the tools. You know, you think about, we're using Acumatica as a ERP we're implementing, but then we're going to use all kinds of no code tools on the back end to help people automate a lot of their systems and get information out of it. We're just going to take this and drop this into a bunch of different industries. So once we're done rolling up foundries in 2, 3, 4, 5 years, which our rough plan is that gets us to about $100 million in sales right now, based on what we're expecting, you know, with the companies we have as targets. We're just going to go do the next one. We'll just be able to take 95%+ of our systems, drop this into the next one we want to go do, and do the exact same thing. So
that's beautiful. I also love, I think you tweeted this a while ago too. I like how you said 100 million in sales versus making 100 million.
Yeah, that drives me fucking nuts.
Very, very important clarification that I don't think anybody talks enough about.
Yeah. You don't make 100 million. That's not the way
it's the dream, but no.
Oh, yeah. I mean, don't get me wrong. If I can do it, that's great. But it's a whole different animal.
Oh,
making 100 million is a lot different than 100 million in sales, for sure. But yeah.
I've got a pretty broad question for you here. Just trying to target and try to provide like the most value to the younger audience here listening.
Yeah.
It's kind of like a vague one. And so if you want to take it however you want, I'm cool with it. More so like if the goal is to make as much money as possible, and let's say that you do have a little bit of cash in the bank, not like $1 million or anything, but let's call it like 100,000. So like maybe you saved up 2 to 3 years out in your career.
Yep.
Where would you go to try to start making as much money as possible, assuming that like the goal is some level of balance between serious wealth and like lifestyle?
So I'll take this two ways.
Yeah.
And I've heard this literally even when I was at GE, they used to tell us this. I heard Jeff Immelt, CEO at the time, say this many, many times. If you want to go make a ton of money, go to Wall Street. You know, he's like, I'll make that introduction. You can go to Goldman, you can go to wherever and just make an obscene amount of money. If you want to learn how to run a business, you go work in corporate America somewhere. Now, I would slightly change that because I think you can do that in a lot of other places. I think you can do that in small businesses. I think you can do that multiple different ways. But yeah, you're not going to have work-life balance in any of those places. If you want to climb up, doesn't matter whether you want to be in some level of banking or private equity or VC or any of that, you are going to work your ass off. Do not think it's anything but that. It's going to be 80, 100, 120 hours. I know a lot of people that have gone through that investment banking side that pretty much fueled themselves on cocaine and alcohol for many years. That is not a joke. That's a reality right there. And then, you know, on the other side, if you want to climb and be an executive, I mean, I was putting 250,000 miles a year on an airplane, and my work week, you know, it started because I had the Middle East. So somewhere between, you know, about midnight, Saturday going into Sunday is when the Middle East starts operations. And when California shut down at, you know, 7-8 o'clock my time on Friday, that was it. So I had 36 hours off. That was it, you know, the entire week. So at best, and you had to catch up and do your real job on Saturday. So I think that if you want to think, you know, what you want to do with $100,000 and you want work-life balance, I've seen a lot of what you guys are doing and what, you know, some of these folks are doing. I think you're like, Connor, you guys have started small businesses, you've grown them, you can take them. I think there's a lot of different things that you could do with them that I couldn't do with them. And just didn't know better at the time. You know, mine was climbing through corporate just to get enough saved and to get the right amount of skill sets that I was really comfortable when I got out. Now, looking back, could I have left late 20s, early 30s? Yeah, I absolutely could have. I didn't need to. It would have had no problem 5-10 years earlier, most likely. But I would say, you know, to go do it, if I were doing it, I would climb up just enough in corporate America, and then you can go hide in a corner for a while, honestly, and search out the right business or start side hustles or do some of these things where you can make some extra cash. And that could be anything from, you know, small real estate portfolio that kicks off cash to, you know, some SaaS business or internet thing, whatever you want to do, whatever your skill set. I think that's the big thing, is that you got to go do what your skill set is, or you have to go learn that skill set. Don't do what everybody else did. It's exactly why I'm successful in manufacturing, is because I had a skill set that other people didn't. And then I exploited the hell out of that. I think that's probably my number one way, is it? So I'm a big believer in doubling down on your strengths and de-risking or minimizing your weaknesses through other people. I think when you work on your weaknesses, you're never going to be good at it. At best, you're going to be half-assed. So, you know, it's better just to figure out how you surround yourself with people that cover up where your weaknesses are.
What do you think specifically was kind of maybe that skill set that you think you were able to execute better than, you know, someone else that was coming in? Was it just being able to deal with all these different people after being in corporate so long? Or?
Yeah, I mean, honestly, it's really about leading. I mean, there's some simple stuff. The stuff that you always talk about in small businesses, understanding generally, you're going to learn it much better, but generally speaking, what accounting is, understanding generally what financials are. So if you can say, hey, I understand how things get booked, I kind of understand taxes, I kind of understand how everything moves between a balance sheet, an income statement, and a cash flow statement. You think kind of those generally basic things, right? Just have that. But then the two biggest things are understanding how to sell and understanding how to lead and develop people. It is impossible to be good at those things unless you want to hire somebody. You know, you and a partner want to go buy a business and they're a salesman that, you know, the old sell ice to Eskimos type of thing. Hey, that's awesome. Amazing. But if you can't do that, you know, you got to figure out a way to partner with somebody to do it. So, because everything is sales and it doesn't matter. Literally, Josh and I were talking about this yesterday on the podcast of his, that it is anything I do, whether I'm selling our business to bankers because we need funding, or I'm selling our vision to employees, or I'm chatting with sellers and the reason why they want to sell to us, that's all selling, every single thing. It's not just getting a new product or getting a new sale or, you know, figuring out how to do the right way to market. Everything in the world is selling. And so, and leading and developing people are the other thing that you just cannot, unless you want to have an individual proprietorship type organization. If you want to get out and get to the point now where, you know, for me personally, I didn't want to be the operator. I'm a shitty operator. Josh is an amazing operator. He does it much better than I am, and he loves it. Like, I've done it, I just hate it. So right now, I mean, it's a running joke where people are like, yeah, must be hard putting in an 8-hour month that you do, but that's probably about what I work now, because every decision I make, right? I'll make three massive decisions, multi-million dollar decisions a year. and I can't be distracted by everything else or else I screw up. I did that one time. I jumped back in the middle of the business and made a bad purchase. And so, you know, it cost us $1 million plus on an acquisition because I was focused on the wrong things. And now that Josh is there, he can't. So, but the only way I can do that is that I had to develop it. I had to figure out how to hire Josh. I had to figure out how to develop the team underneath before Josh got there, right? So you have to develop people that go from a blue collar worker to a supervisor, or a supervisor to a plant manager, or a plant manager to a general manager, or a plant manager to a director of operations for us. Figure out how to, like, and especially when you get outside your comfort zone, understanding how to hire the right people. Like if you need to hire a controller or a CFO and you don't know shit about finances and accounting, that becomes really hard. Same thing if you're trying to hire a marketing and finance, or sorry, marketing and salesperson, and you have never done it, that's really hard. So you have to get good at understanding how to hire and develop people, or else your organization just going to be stuck. And it doesn't, you know, even if you go from yourself to two people, you know, you want to hire one person. That's a much more critical hire.
I think, right, it always sounds so easy to like, all right, you just got to make sure you develop people well and you hire the right people. I think at least the few years of experience that Connor and I have, I think we found that people tend to be the most difficult part of any 100%. Business we've ran or have run.
Right.
Any specific tips or tricks, or I guess, how did you develop that relationship maybe with Josh, and how do you align incentives for that higher, you know, I guess level management in terms of you guys are doing roll-ups. Yep. How do you make sure he's aligned with what you're trying to do? People are getting compensated fairly and they're hired and developed, you know, well.
Yeah. So there's two elements of this, of your question, I think. So let's start with the development of people. The one thing, it's the key way, there's a concept and then an actual way to do it in my mind. Conceptually, you no longer are the person that has to make the decision. You have to figure out how to delegate and be totally fine with whatever people that you have now working for you, that they're going to make mistakes. You are there as a sounding board. And so tactically, how does that happen? When someone comes to you with a question, or you're curious what they're doing, or even if you think you're doing it wrong, you can't tell them. You have to ask questions. You have to literally lead them all the way to eventually where they need to get, but they have to learn, because if you're still there, they never learn, and you're always going to continue to be a key cog, and you'll get yourself spread too thin, you'll burn yourself out, et cetera, et cetera. And the easy way to think about this, kind of my mental structure and framework when I start kind of training managers to be managers, which is a whole other animal, is that they need to think in their minds like, okay, I might be at 120% of this person. Maybe that person is at 60% or 80%. So, okay, well, that's not sustainable. You can't continue to operate at 120%. You're going to burn out and eventually you're going to be totally worthless. So even if you're at 100% and you're doing higher value add work and that person's at 60, your output per se together is 160% versus you doing 120 and them doing 20 or nothing, right? And so it's kind of the mentality of you have to develop people and you have to get them there. And the biggest thing is once you start owning, but and again, that's the same mentality, whether you're a manager in a company or whether you own your own company. The biggest mental hurdle you need to get over when it's your own company is you have to realize that's your money they're going to spend. You know, I own 100%. Every mistake they make, even when I know it's a mistake, you know, that's going to cost us money. So I've seen my team, they've talked to me, they'll make a decision like, I don't agree with it. Here's the way I think it. But ultimately, your job is to make the decision. My job is to hold you accountable. But I've watched my team burn $100,000 in front of me. Like, yep, there's $100,000 of mine that I no longer have but they learn. That's tuition. That's got to be the game, right? Now, the key is they can't continue to make that mistake. I have to hold them accountable. Hey, you made this mistake. What are you going to do? What are you going to do to fix that? How do you rectify it? How do you learn? Like, that is ultimately the way it is. So that's kind of the answer to your first question of how I think about developing people. The second part on really what it takes to incentivize people, you need to have them aligned with whatever it is. So we've moved quite literally all the way down to our supervisors and plant managers. Our big thing right now is we need to generate cash. We've got plenty of profits, but cash generation, when you're growing a business, especially something like ours, where we've 10x'd in 5 years, you you burn a lot of working capital. You're going to need more inventory. Your accounts receivable increases substantially. You need CapEx to grow, you know, in manufacturing. These are all the things. If you're selling software, none of this applies. But for us, you know, you need to turn all that stuff in. So we needed to align all of our incentives for people to what is most important to us right now, which is cash generation. There's still principles they have to run by. They have to keep their employees safe. They have to build a quality product. They have, you know, it's literally in our every, it's all over our company. It's number one is health and safety of employees. Number two, customer satisfaction. Number three, quality product. Number four, deliver that quality product on time. Number five, worry about profit. And it's scattered everywhere, all over our organization, any place you walk into. But then what that means is ultimately we need to align them to what we want. Now, specifically as it goes with my executive team, like I mentioned before, my wife and I have been very lucky. We've done well. We're not having kids. So everybody that's on our executive team that's building this is going to inherit the company. So they know everything they're building from now until, you know, whenever. We'll figure out ways to take care of it once all the bills are paid and loans are paid off, et cetera. But you know, they know that they're developing generational wealth. My expectation is, you know, this should be well into a 9-figure business if we ever decide to sell. But, you know, ultimately, I don't know why we would sell. Just kick off a whole lot of cash every year and go do the next thing. Make sure those folks are taken care of. And ultimately probably ends up in some sort of a trust where their heirs are able to get access to excess cash, but ultimately they can't get access to the assets. And we'll have a professional team, roughly speaking, and kind of how this will be. And, you know, the first one is going to be Foundries, but I can envision a bunch of other ones after this.
That's a really cool way to think about it. I've never actually heard anyone talk about it that much in terms of like their own employees and setting them up for success that way. I think one like issue that I sometimes have with bigger business podcasts for me personally is that if you listen to enough of them, it all kind of boils down to like kind of what you said earlier of like hiring and leadership are like the two fundamental skills. But I think then you went a little bit further here and you kind of were chatting about developing the skill of sales and how sales is kind of at the crux of everything. And I feel like just speaking to maybe some younger audiences who right now who like candidly, for the next 5 to 10 years, they're probably not going to be in a position to hire unless they're doing their own thing and switching things up. And like management still might be a little bit farther away too. I do definitely think that sales is probably the best skill for a young person to develop 100%. Solely also because like it impacts all of those latter ones. Like I know prior to this call today, I had Gio and I are trying to hire an operations manager right now for managing all of the real estate. And so I had like 6 interviews this morning. I think I have maybe 4 this afternoon or something like that as well. But like half of it's me trying to figure out if, you know, these people are qualified and able to work. The other half of it is me convincing them to leave, you know, a $300 billion real estate fund and come work for Gio and I for 40 hours a week. And like, be like, no, I swear to God, like we will pay you like you know, flexible work culture, like whatever you want.
Right.
But it's definitely from a sales standpoint, like it's a huge skill and applies both to the management side of convincing them, like what you're saying here, convincing them that profit and company profit is like the 5th or 6th value in your company and convincing them of that vision and convincing them to come work for you and dedicate 40 to 50 to 60 hours a week of their time.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think, you know, sales is thought of a little differently depending on where it is, but it's not, I mean, honestly, even if you want, it doesn't matter. You're 22 years old, you just graduated college, or, you know, you're starting your first job. You have to figure out how to promote yourself and sell yourself. People aren't going to take care of your career in corporate. This isn't like a teacher that's going to ask or a professor that's going to ask or your parents, they're going to ask. It doesn't matter where you are. The only way you climb in corporate America, you have to do the work, but they're not going to notice if you just do the work. You have to sell yourself. You have to promote yourself. And it doesn't matter what it is. You have to do the little extra things on the side that make sure that people know about it. And that sucks. That is not, I mean, some people, don't get me wrong, are totally fine with it. It wasn't, don't get me wrong. I'm plenty egotistical myself, but I'm plenty arrogant, but still it's hard to sell yourself, like to say, hey, look what I did. But in some regards, you need to do that. And that's part of sales, is to do it without coming off being slimy or, you know, giving somebody a used car salesman type of feel. But it is the story. And, you know, it's kind of, I always use this back to sort of a, I love stand-up comedy. I think it's awesome. I love the process they go through. Someday when I'm independently wealthy and I don't need to worry about how bad I'm going to embarrass myself, maybe I'll do it. But I love what they go through because you hone your pitch, you figure out what that is. They know exactly when they're going to get a laugh and they'll practice it 100 different ways and 100 different times. And that's no different than what you have to do with your career and how you need to figure out how to make that work. So you think about some comedians will just give a one-liner, right? They're totally fine with it. And other people tell stories. I'm much more of the storyteller per se, you know, tell a funny story over time. But that's exactly how I pitch my career. I left, obviously, fourth company was to go do this, but I left three companies and I didn't apply to any one of those jobs. They went and found me. I was never qualified for any of the jobs I walked into, but I was able to sell, hey, here's what I've done. Here's what I'm willing to do. I don't know how to do this, but I'll figure it out. And here's how I'd go about figuring it out. Like that is a canned pitch. And that way of selling yourself literally works from the time you're trying to build an individual contributor career all the way to today when I'm trying to sell banks on wanting to provide us money or people wanting to sell us their business or employees. You know, it doesn't matter, right? We've got a leadership development thing that we're starting with our newer employees and younger employees. And I talk to them and I tell them the exact same thing. Like, hey, we'll help you to get through this stuff. But right now you need to help yourself. Like I don't need your dad calling me to ask me what you're going to do this summer. You joke. I literally had that happen one time at corporate. I had a dad somehow find me and ask me what his kid was going to do. I'm like, bro,
want to know what he's going to do? Not work here.
Yeah, exactly. He's like four levels below me somewhere in an organization. I think I met him one time. Like, why would I have any idea what you're
doing? That's funny. But
yeah. So it's just one of those things, right? You have to do it in sales. And then again, like you can learn to lead people without managing, right? I mean, that's, I think, the other big thing, especially if people are working a job, you need to show that capability and say, hey, you know, we used to call it leader of leaders. So even if you weren't a manager, you didn't have direct responsibility, there's still a ton of places where you can influence your organization and that skill set will help you forever. You know, for me, I think I would say that I learned it probably playing sports growing up as a kid, but there's lots of other ways to develop that. We had some of those things where I think it's absolutely key because that skill will help you forever as well. And then you just need to figure out how to formalize it into then helping other people learn how to manage people and develop people. And that's just a repetition thing. There's no magic to that. That's almost as much trial and error. You just have to have a general framework of how you do it. And then you need to try it. It's what I call time over target. It's, you know, you don't get the reps in and you're going to suck at it. The first time you fire somebody, you're going to suck at it. The likelihood you're going to do well on your first hire is pretty low. Let's go through it and get used to it. And the more reps, the better you get and the easier it becomes.
In terms of maybe some of your own self-development, obviously you've gone through the corporate route. As you mentioned, the reps are going to be important. You've probably hired and fired, you know, an unlucky and lucky amount of people at this point. Are there things you're doing in terms of whether that's, you know, books you read or articles or websites or maybe peer groups that you're in? Yeah. I'm not sure if there's a Foundry peer group, probably not. Twitter, you know, how are you, if you think you are, you know, staying on top of maybe your own learning and education and making sure you're also pulling in some of the knowledge you want to be?
Yeah. So this is a recommendation for everybody. Literally just tweeted this out last night and it's just blowing up currently. Well, blowing up for me, not you guys with 100,000 followers or something, but you have to find a peer group. Whether you're buying a business or whether you're in the spot, like you need to find a group that you can talk with and that are going similarly through the events that you're going through, which is exactly what I'm doing right now. So we've got a holdco and a cohort. There's about a dozen of us right now. And it is everything from myself doing foundries to a bunch of other people in the group are doing plumbing or HVAC, or they've raised funds and they bought totally disparate businesses. Another guy's got literally everything from a franchise restaurant to a solar install company. But what we find is that we help each other out immensely. For anybody that's just starting out in a business, it's even more important because small business ownership is the worst, the loneliest job in the world. because you don't get to bitch about the boss. Like, it wasn't like when you're like, hey, sitting in the cube, like, oh, look at this dipshit, our boss. You're like, oh shit, I'm the dipshit now. So you don't get to have that. And all of a sudden you're like, you don't know what to do. And so everything that goes wrong is your fault. And especially you get a spouse and you just sign a $2 million personal guarantee or something. And 4 months in, you realize, oh my God, I just lost $2 million of our money, which isn't really happen, but you know, this is why you need a peer group. It's so important. I think it's the number one thing. Then for me personally, on top of the peer groups, it has been, I use executive coaches through the years personally. Now at this point in time, it's, I don't, the skill, the individual skill set of buying businesses, and, you know, that stuff isn't really there. Now it's much more about personal development for me, making sure that I'm handling it the right way for, you know, my relationships, whether that be personal, family, work, whatever, and that I'm continuing to develop and figuring out, you know, my personal take is I want to be a little more zen in my life. Let's just say that wasn't exactly my personality back in the day. So a little more calm, a little more relaxed. It's kind of a natural thing you have or you don't have, but at the same time, once in a while, I still enjoy yelling at people. Just feels like it needs to come out. But now I'm trying to put that away most of the time.
I got to imagine with the peer group side of things too, like there's certainly times where you'll probably leave and your notepad will be full of like new ideas on hiring practices, platforms, software tools, whatever like that you want to try. But I would, if I had to guess, like 90% of it's just therapy. Probably just,
yeah. Oh, 100%.
Just hearing that everyone else is having a bad time
makes, yeah,
you're having,
yeah,
such a better time.
Exactly right. Like, and I tell, and again, for the first 18 months, and I know that the group skews a little younger, but this is a good thing to know because eventually a lot of people, I'm guessing, want to get into this. The first 18 months of business ownership is terrible. It, like, literally 6 months in, I was curled up on my bathroom floor at 2 a.m. on a Tuesday because I thought for sure I'd ruin my wife and I's, you know, retirement money. Like, it costs us everything, right? And it's just what it is. You just learn to get used to it. And that peer group, because everybody goes through it. So it's key. You find a peer group and then you find a mentor that's more like 5 years ahead of you. And then you find another mentor or two that are like 20 years ahead of you. Your peer group, you should be able to talk to all the time. I mean, it's a lot of bullshitting. It's a lot of giving each other a hard time, but still you can also ask anything in that peer group. You can peel it off. Someone's having a bad day. Someone's freaking out, you know, someone needs to figure out how to hire. I mean, there's the tactical stuff, but there's also, yeah, to your point, it's 100% as much about therapy and just developing a relationship and knowing that you can say anything to anyone and it's a fun time. And then, you know, it does need to get serious. There's people that are going to take care of you as well. And then those mentors really help you because they've been there, they've done that. You know, I joke about, I totally freaked out about like a $26,000 fix we had like 7 months in. That's what pretty much caused me to end up on the bathroom floor at 2 a.m. But now, you know, or even 2 years later, it was like $160,000 check that we'd written out for something in our, and that we didn't code it right. And the accountant was asking me what it was. I had no idea. And I was like, I think it's this. Come to find out, it wasn't that. Now, the idea that I could ever write out a $170,000 check and not know what it was, didn't think that was ever going to happen in my life, but it just, yeah, kind of becomes the norm. But you have to have that peer group to get you through. And so, like, with the perspective of a mentor that's 5 years in and someone who's probably already done it for 20 years, like, that's invaluable as well. You don't need to talk to them all the time like your peer group. It can be once a month or every 3 months or just on the one-off when your peer group doesn't know how to handle it or, you know, someone's looking for advice. But it's the number one missed thing, whether it is in your career or in business ownership. And it's the number, I can't say how valuable it is. It's literally almost invaluable. It's so important.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. Reg, this episode definitely far exceeded my expectations, and not only learning more exactly what casting is and everything that you're working on, but I feel like just really practical advice for management, skills to develop, where to go forward. If people want to go and follow some of the work that you're putting out, where can they go and find you?
Best place is at Reg Zeller on Twitter. It's, just one of many out there, but I'm at least building in public, trying to talk as much about the losses as the wins, because I don't learn a whole lot from the wins, but the losses are real painful. So if anyone can not do that. That's amazing. And I'll say for anybody, I've helped a lot of people kind of develop, whether it be in their corporate careers or moving from corporate into small business, or once they're in small business, DMs are open, happy to help out any possible way I can, point anybody in the right direction. I've had so many people that have helped me growing up. It's the least I can do to give back and try and help other folks.
Really helpful. Thank you again for your time today, Reg.
If you thought today's episode was awesome, we would love it if you would leave a 5-star review on the podcast, either on Spotify or Apple Podcasts. It makes a huge difference and lets us get cooler and cooler guests for future episodes.